and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, Broadway musicals, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode one, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a man who's been a part of Mac and Apple journalism for about as long as I can remember, which may not sound like much until you realise that I started using Macs professionally in 1992. Over the years, he's been editor-in-chief of Macworld, editorial director at its publishers IDG, and has now gone indie to run tech news and commentary site sixcolors.com. But you may also know him as the founder and mainstay of the incomparable network of podcasts, where he's spent the last few years devouring and dissecting pretty much every side of geek and pop culture you can imagine, which is just one of the reasons I invited him onto this show. He is, of course, Mr. Jason Snell. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm honored to be here, and that was a great introduction. I need to explain no more about myself. You got it.
Having been freelance myself for so many years, I've gotten very good at writing, you know, those third party. Anthony is a veteran writer of such and such, mm-hmm. So a lot of practice.
Yeah, people always say send a bio, and you're like, okay. And then you write one about yourself that is as if you didn't write it. It's very strange.
It is very odd, a very strange sort of traditional practice. So let's talk about your choice. And well, first of all, why don't you tell us what you've chosen to talk about and give us some context of its release and the reception around it and why it's considered uncool or, you know, bad, and, you know, your opinions on that.
Well, I think you're going to find this with a lot of your guests, that they're going to say, well, I don't really like anything that's truly bad, but which is probably not true. I decided I racked my brain to try and think of what I could bring on the show. And I came up with Stargate SG-1, the science fiction TV series, because it is so uncool, and because of when it came out and what followed it and what its format was and how long it lasted as a franchise. But it was on in the US, it was on Showtime and then on the Sci-Fi Channel. It aired from 1997 to about 2007. And, you know, I love television sci-fi. I like science fiction in all its forms, actually. And I loved this show so much. And I'll grant you that maybe it fell apart a little bit at the end, but I love the show a lot. And I feel like it's not even in the conversation. And when it comes up, it's just, people don't even want to bring it up. I think it's so uncool. It's not something people talk about as a sci-fi series. A year or two ago, I might have mentioned Babylon 5, which I think is a really good show, but I don't think Babylon 5 is even as poorly thought of. I think it's just considered, well, it was kind of old. I feel like it's been rehabbed a little bit. Stargate, not so much. I feel like it's just fallen into this pit where it doesn't get any respect. People don't really seek it out, and it's considered kind of old and uninteresting. And that's not what it is. It's much better than that.
I mean, I confess, I never watched a single episode of Stargate, not for any reason. I did see the movie. And that was fine, but the...
I'm not here to defend the movie, actually. We can get into that. I didn't really like the movie.
Honestly, the only bits I really remember from the movie are Kurt Russell in a beret.
Yes.
The Stargate itself, obviously. And a really dodgy piece of CGI where an Egyptian pharaoh death mask is actually revealed to be a space helmet. And it kind of transforms in bad CGI. That's literally all I remember about the movie.
Don't go back and look. I will not defend the feature film. And that's one of the stories behind this whole franchise, is that this is one of those franchises that did not have a particularly good steward. And so we ended up with sort of conflicting. It's a very strange story of how this whole franchise came to be.
Well, do you think that maybe if it had started as a TV show, it would be better remembered?
Well, I think it would be less confusing. Because you definitely have people who say, well, it wasn't that movie with Kurt Russell and James Spader. And it is. And the show is essentially a continuation of it, but I completely
forgot James Spader, wasn't it?
Yeah. Most of the world building was sort of thrown away by the series. The people who were involved with the series didn't have any involvement with the movie, and vice versa. And in fact, I believe the people who did the movie have completely denounced the series and have a plan to make more movies in the series and completely ignore what happened on television, which is also kind of fascinating. It's a little like, I think the Terminator would be another example of a franchise that doesn't really know what. I had several people tell me if James Cameron didn't do it, it's just fan fiction.
I can get on board with that, to be perfectly honest with you.
I agree. But then you've got the sort of like, you've got movies that contradict each other and a TV series that it's unclear what's happening there. And Stargate's a little bit like that too. But, I don't know. We can get into it. I think timing was not on Stargate's side, that it was in the US, it was on pay cable. So it wasn't initially seen by anybody.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was going to say part of the reason I didn't watch it. The time period that it came out, for some of those years, I genuinely just didn't own a television, but also over here, it was shown on Sky, which is a pay, not cable, but satellite network, and is also Rupert Murdoch's outfit, so I won't have it in the house. So there was no way I was ever going to see it. And it was also, as you'll know, it was before the era of commonly available TV box sets.
Yes, yes. In fact, I think one of the first box sets I ever bought was the Stargate SG-1 Season 1 box. And it was one of those things where I think I discovered it on what they did was they would run it in syndication. So a couple years after, or a year after it ran on Showtime, it would run in the middle of the afternoon on a TV channel, just a regular free over-the-air TV channel. And so that's where I caught it for the first time. And I was expecting it to be sort of the quality of other sci-fi series like Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda or something like that, that was running on syndication on the weekend at 3 PM, where you don't put things that you're proud of. But I really liked it. And so then it became a strategy of how to find it. When was it actually on? And I remember when the DVDs came out, I was really excited because, and this predates Netflix or something, I just bought the DVDs because I figured I'd only seen a handful of those episodes because they were early episodes. And that's how I kind of got into it. But I got into it to the point where the last season it was on Showtime, I bought Showtime. And I had never up to that point ever paid for a premium channel before, but I really wanted to see the new episodes of Stargate, so I did. And then after that year, Showtime essentially canceled it, and the Sci-Fi Channel picked it up, and it ran for like another 5 years, I think, on the Sci-Fi Channel.
And is that also a pay cable channel?
That's a cable channel, but it's not a premium channel. So you can't get it over the air, but it's just part of any TV system.
So if you have a basic cable package, you'll get Sci-Fi.
You'll get the Sci-Fi Channel, right? Where Showtime, you're going to pay an extra $10 a month or $15 a month for Showtime, just like HBO. It's one of those. So that its audience expanded pretty dramatically, and the reruns were on the Sci-Fi Channel at that point. And I guess what I'm saying is it had a very strange launch because it was based on this movie that was vaguely remembered and on pay cable. And, I think it never had its moment.
And then changed half of the stuff from the movie anyway.
Exactly. And then switched cable channels in the middle. So I feel like on one level, it's kind of miraculous that it had any success at all. And it definitely has its fans. And it spawned multiple spinoff TV series. But at the same time, I think it never really caught people, caught the zeitgeist in a way that a lot of other science fiction shows have. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why it's kind of forgotten.
Could that possibly be because it also felt more like a network show? I mean, like I said, I never saw a whole episode, but I have seen bits and pieces, and it did, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but it kind of felt like, like if you switch on and you watch something like NCIS now, it felt like a network show that is designed to run and run and run and hits the reset button at the start of every episode and just, kind of feels like a network show. And that's not really the way sci-fi, I mean, even Star Trek has never quite felt that way until, maybe sort of towards the end, but it never really felt like that. And that is a style of show that sci-fi fans tend to normally avoid, possibly because they regard them as thoughtless.
Well, I think one of the strengths and weaknesses of the show was that, especially in the early days, Stargate was it always had a story arc. It wasn't that it, like Star Trek The Next Generation, that had no story arc, but the story arcs were very gentle, and there were lots of standalone episodes. And I think that was intentional, that they wanted this to be sold into syndication after it was on Showtime, and they wanted it to be accessible for people. I think it's the tone more than the format. I think that the fact that this was a military team, and they were, especially at the beginning, you know, it was a fairly clean cut, well lit, you know, friendly looking group of people, and very different from where things were going with, not too long after this, Battlestar Galactica, which was, again, that was a Sci-Fi Channel original series too. They weren't, and they were both shot in Vancouver. They were not that different on a lot of levels. Shared some actors in common, even, but the tone was very different between them.
Right, and this was something that we talked about, you and I, in email actually before the show, which is that it feels like Stargate was the last of the previous generation of sci-fi shows before Battlestar Galactica came along and just changed the game for everyone. I mean, that really did just change the way sci-fi was done on television completely.
Right.
It's kind of how, I always bring things back to a music analogy. It's kind of how, do you remember how in 1991, everybody still thought bands like Motley Crue were really cool, they were totally awesome, and this was great.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly, in September 1991, this little album called Nevermind was released. Mm. And suddenly, Motley Crue felt 10 years out of date, just completely and hopelessly out of date. And maybe that's what happened to Stargate with Battlestar Galactica. It changed things so much that you immediately looked at a show from what we might call the previous generation, like Stargate. And even though it wasn't that old, it immediately looked completely terribly old.
I think so. I think Battlestar Galactica is the dividing line here in many ways. That this Battlestar Galactica changed, I think, the way that a lot of us looked at science fiction TV, the way we looked at it critically, the way we took it seriously as, you know, serious kind of art with important things to say. And, you know, that all happened right around, that happened as Stargate was on the air for a few years and was, I think it felt a bit old in comparison, which is not to say that Stargate didn't have the story arcs, but it was not gritty. It was not telling an allegory about post 9/11 America, which is definitely what Battlestar Galactica was trying to do. I also wonder if it was too much in the Star Trek mold of heroes instead of anti-heroes. Like, so you look at something like Firefly, and it's a spaceship show where the spaceship people are outlaws. And they're with a heart of gold, of course, but outlaws. And Stargate is, like Star Trek, a military show. It's military officers are the main cast of this show. It is not, I would say, your average episode of JAG or something like that. But the fact was, on a quick read, you would say, this is square. This is old and well lit, and these are big, you know, heroes. And it's not, it's not the playing with the format that would come shortly thereafter. So yeah, I think that's definitely an aspect of it.
That's an interesting comparison to draw. Yeah, the Outlaws with a Heart of Gold is a fairly traditional sci-fi trope, fairly traditional Western trope, of course. But yeah, very traditional style of sci-fi character. And I didn't know that Stargate wasn't like that, that it was a bit more straight-laced. So yeah, that's an interesting contrast, I think, and an interesting route for the show to take.
It's what the contrast is between the anti-hero or the people who are definitely on the right side, but they're rebelling against the big empire, essentially. You know, take it back to Star Wars, and Stargate is like Star Trek. These are the people who work for the big government and are here to help you. And although there were some subversive things, I think, in Stargate, and it was definitely not a super serious show like a JAG or something like that, it was still, that was what the concept was. And yes, I think it was very easy to look at that show in the context of something like Battlestar Galactica or Firefly and find it wanting.
Okay, so tell me why, you know, why none of that matters? Why, despite all these things, you still love it? Because as you say, it is very clean cut. It's all heroes, not anti-heroes, brightly lit, network, syndication, all of that. All the things that most sci-fi fans would go and recoil at. So why do you love it in spite of all these things?
Well, as a child of the original Star Trek, as somebody who grew up watching the original Star Trek, one of the things that really captured my imagination about science fiction in general, science fiction television in particular, was this idea of exploration, that every week we were going to have an interesting group of main characters, but every week they were going to discover something that was interesting. And this has taken other forms. I mean, something that I loved about the X-Files was that every week, even though there would be story arcs and there was some complexity, every week there would be a discovery. They would find, and essentially it would be, tell me a story about this place. What's going to happen? What are we going to learn? What are the complications going to be? And one of the things I really loved about Stargate was that it captured that in a way that I felt like no other science fiction TV show for me had captured it since Star Trek. That sense that, and like Next Generation maybe too, that the premise of Stargate is you've got this team of people and they're not straight-laced, although they are military. You've got the scientist, you've got sort of a wacky scientist, you've got a super smart military scientist, you've got an iconoclastic colonel who's running the outfit, who reports to a straight-laced general, but the guy in charge of the team, and this is Richard Dean Anderson, MacGyver. He's a really likable actor, really likable character. You've got kind of an alien Spock. He's sort of like muscle Spock, which is Teal'c. And so you've got this interesting team, and then every week, essentially, they are dialing. It's a little like War Games. They're literally like just dialing numbers and seeing what happens. That's the premise of Stargate at the beginning, is they've got this thing that will let you basically go to another planet, step through the ring to another planet, but they don't know what they're going to get, and they're trying to figure it out. And I love that sense of exploration, that every week they're going to step through the gate. They don't know what's going to be on the other side. They're puny modern humans. They're not even what we hope to be in 200 years. They are us today with this opportunity to step through a gate that you can't see the other side of. You just have to step through it and be brave and discover what strange world lies on the other side. And I love that. I think that's a great premise, and I think that it was very well executed, especially in the first sort of 5 years or so before, you know, I would argue that Stargate had 4 or 5 years of story in it, and you get to the point where you have to switch out cast members and make new story arcs and resolve your old story arcs, and you almost end up with a different show the last 5 years that it was on. But that first 5 years, especially, it was a great combination of adventure and humor, and some really nice science fictional concepts, and that sense that every week you didn't know what you were going to get, and that you were taking that journey with the characters. That sense of adventure, I think, hard to capture. And I like that. I wouldn't want every single show to be like that, but I also wouldn't, you know, I like having a show like that where the adventure is there, and it's not like Firefly. I love Firefly, but Firefly, so much of Firefly is just we're paying the bills, or we had to pick something up, or we had to land on this planet, and they're making do, they're getting by, and then stories happen with these interesting characters. That's a different kind of thing than saying, you know, hey, we are you today, given this amazing opportunity to walk up a ramp and step through this shimmering CGI pool and end up on another planet. So I think there's a lot of appeal from the adventure, but also the modern setting, I think, is really great. That's you don't usually see that, I think, in a show like in a space show. You see other
right.
fantasy sci-fi shows set in the present day, but I don't think you see a space show set in the present day. I mean, Doctor Who is an example, actually, of a show that takes people from today and puts them in science fictional premises, and I like that too.
Very true. It always has done. Yeah. I mean, the danger, it did always strike me, the danger's lessened somewhat when you can just turn around and, you know, go straight back through.
Well, that's how you have to build your, you have to build your complications in about, you have to, there needs to be a dialing device on the other side so that you can dial home. And if they, somebody's got control, or you get lost, or you get captured, and you know, you end up with those plot complications that, that sometimes can be a little eye rolling. I definitely felt like, that's one of the great, innovations of modern Doctor Who, is that they invented the psychic paper, which essentially yes. prevents the 15 minutes of you being, you know, the, watching the main characters be put in jail, trying to talk their way out, finally escaping, you know, just, let's just skip past that, because that's really boring.
And I do feel that one of the reasons most Americans who have newly discovered Doctor Who should not attempt to go back and watch the old stuff is partly because of the lack of things like the psychic paper.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, I know that you're familiar with old Doctor Who, but so many, especially American viewers, aren't.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
true.
They'll watch those shows and think, well, just get your psychic paper out.
Like, no, this is why the psychic paper was invented, because yeah. I'm sure Russell Davis was typing up and he was like, oh, yeah, I suppose they would probably lock them up right here. Well, I need to solve that problem. So we'll use the psychic paper to do it. And Stargate, again, had to engineer some of that. They're built into the mythos is the idea that you have to dial the Stargate and it only stays open for a certain amount of time. And they built in, and you can't step, you have to make a connection to go back, and it's a one-way connection. I think it's a one-way connection. They built in some things to try and make it complicated enough that they couldn't just solve it by running away.
Right.
but, you know, you end up, I don't know. The exploration thing is the thing that always has struck me about that show. And yeah, I do think it's funny. So it's funny. We listed all of the liabilities first and, you know, getting around to the assets. It's funny to do it in that direction, but I think those are the primary assets. I think one of the things that they lifted from the movie and then expanded upon is this idea that all of, and it's an old idea, and there were the Chariots of the Gods books and things that. The idea that all of the mythological gods were aliens, and they're still out there, and now we're meeting them, and that was actually, that they turned that into some interesting story arcs. There were the ones that were based on Egyptian mythology that were very bad aliens, and there were the ones based on Norse mythology, and they were good aliens, and that ended up being pretty interesting. I found the show became less interesting when they started to spend time on spaceships and spaceships were flying around, because again, you lose, then it's just another spaceship show. And
you lose that grounded element.
Well, and in fact, I would say that one of the smartest things about Star Trek was the invention of the transporter, right? And that was like with a psychic paper, that is a dramatic invention. That it's a time saver, but it's a dramatic invention. We don't need to spend time getting from the ship to the surface. Let's just have them, well, they're on the surface now. Through magic, they're on the surface. And the Stargate was like that. That
we don't have to fly through space to reach another planet.
Exactly. And so you don't end up with the thing that always, you know, made me sad when I would watch a Star Trek The Next Generation or even Deep Space Nine episode back, is, you know, fade in on a spaceship going through space. You know, it's just like, oh, here we are again. We're on a spaceship and we're going to spend the first 5 minutes seeing what happens to the people on the spaceship. And maybe there'll be a planet eventually. And with Stargate, it's just dispensed with. They literally just walk up the ramp and walk out onto an alien planet, and then they have to figure it out. And I like that. I like that the purity of just saying, look, this is about us going to other planets, and not, this is about us on a spaceship that might break down, and there might be another spaceship, and there might be an anomaly that we have to fly past. And I just, you know, I love Star Trek, but that was one of the things that I liked about Stargate, is that it dispensed with the spaceship dynamic a little bit.
Right. Yeah. You love Star Trek, but you've got Star Trek already. You don't need another one.
There are many Star Treks available.
It's interesting that you mentioned X-Files, because when we were talking about sort of how Battlestar Galactica changed everything, it occurred to me that X-Files was kind of the same that X-Files was like the Next Generation after Star Trek Next Generation.
Yes.
If you'll pardon the repetition. And so, you know, X-Files kind of blew Next Generation away, because it felt so fresh and so new and not like Star Trek, not like sci-fi that we'd seen on TV before. And then there was Deep Space Nine kind of maybe tried to glom onto that a little bit. But yeah, so it does feel like there's a generational thing going on with sci-fi there. And it's not based around technology. It's about storytelling techniques.
Mm-hmm. And I think the mainstream, one way to define this is that the mainstream media and a wider audience than the people who, you know, will seek out televised science fiction and see what, you know, they'll try anything because, and then they'll see what they like. Getting a much broader audience to tune into a science fiction show has been hard. And I think that's one of the things you can do is you can point to those moments when, even if it wasn't a huge audience, when people were talking about it and when it was in the newspapers and in the magazines and on websites and like that critics were taking it seriously. And I can list, there were very few shows like that where critics really took it seriously. And Star Trek The Next Generation was nominated for an Emmy Award its last year on when the Best of Both Worlds cliffhanger happened. People were really talking about it. I felt like that was that moment when that show broke through into a really much broader consciousness. The X-Files became a breakout hit for Fox in the US.
It was over here as well. It was huge over here. Yeah.
It was enormous, much bigger than you'd expect. I mean, that was a Friday night show that you just put on because you've got to put something on. And then they moved it to Sunday night. They moved it to the big TV ratings night because it was a huge hit and they got huge ratings for it. You could say maybe something like Buffy got a lot of critical acclaim, although it didn't get viewed by a lot of people. There was a lot of critical conversation about it. Certainly Battlestar Galactica, although it never got massive ratings, was a huge part of the conversation. And so those are those moments where something breaks through and is talked about a lot more. And you might say something like Game of Thrones, although yep, fantasy yep. and not science fiction is having that moment too. And I think that's one of the, I think Stargate never having that moment and being in such close proximity to Battlestar Galactica, having that moment is one of the reasons why I thought of bringing it up here is that it's sort of gotten lost in the shuffle. And I think unfairly, because it's trying to do something else, and because I think it actually did a pretty good job. Although, like the X-Files, both of them outstayed their welcome.
Well, and that's another thing that's interesting. I looked up the dates, and I hadn't realized this, but Stargate was still going long after Battlestar Galactica started.
Yes.
Battlestar Galactica was almost finished. It was more than halfway through its, three-and-a-half season run when Stargate went off the air, which, if you'd asked me before looking it up, I would have said, oh no, Stargate finished in the early 2000s, like long before Battlestar Galactica. And maybe that's because it has that kind of slightly old-fashioned feel to it compared to BSG.
Yeah, it did outstay its welcome. They ended up doing 10 seasons. They changed out most of the cast. Richard Dean Anderson didn't want to move full-time to Canada and got tired of the grind and wanted to be done. And I think he was in every episode for about 5 or 6 years, and then he was in half, and then he was in a couple, and then he just vanished because he didn't want to do it. And losing your star is tough. Imagine if Star Trek came back for a fourth season, but Captain Kirk was only in 4 episodes. That would have been a tough one to swallow. And then the rest of them just sort of hung around and said, well, Captain Kirk is back on Earth, but let's go to this planet anyway.
We're boldly going without him. Yeah. And the fact that he was MacGyver as well, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, let's be honest, nobody knows his name. He's MacGyver.
He's MacGyver, yeah.
And my mom watched MacGyver. She loved mm-hmm. MacGyver. He was MacGyver, the guy with the mullet who could make a machine gun out of a rusty bedspring and a packet of Marlboro. You know,
indeed,
that was him. And then for him to effectively go slum it on a sci-fi show, you know, which my mother would never watch.
Well, have you watched any of those episodes of MacGyver? They were not very good.
Believe me. No, I know. But it was the time, wasn't it? It was the era of, you know, Knight Rider and Stephen J. Cannell shows and all that sort of stuff.
It was a cut above those. But I think, though, one advantage Stargate had, especially since it was based on a movie and wasn't obviously going to have Kurt Russell or James Spader, was by casting Richard Dean Anderson, he brought MacGyver with him. He brought that, I think that was a great advantage to the show, not only because he was really good on the show, but because he brought some credibility and some shorthand that even though this was supposedly the same character Kurt Russell, right? Same, theoretically the same character that Kurt Russell played in the movies, although with two L's in his last name instead of one, O'Neill, which was, I think that was the joke, and he would occasionally say two L's. It's like maybe it's a different guy.
O'Neill, Two L's.
He wasn't going to be Kurt Russell. He wasn't going to be the military guy, even though he was a colonel or a major or whatever he was in the military. He brought the rebellious anti-establishment vibe from MacGyver along with him. And as a result, you got somebody who was had a lot of idiosyncrasies and did not he was never the gruff military guy who was always going to go by the book. And that would have killed the show, I would argue. In fact, in later years, I think they added a character who was very much that. And that's another one of those annoying plot developments that some shows come up with where it's like, well, two characters will argue about whether this is the right regulation. Like, no, I don't want to see that. So Richard Dean Anderson, I think, I think the show succeeded because of his presence on it, and that the show was a much looser, and took itself less seriously in part because of what he brought, not only as himself, but as MacGyver, into, you know, from people's minds. There's no way they could have had him play, and nor I think would the actor have wanted to play a completely serious military guy. And that was good, because if I describe this show as a show about a military team, it seems very different than what the actual show is, which is not like that at all.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, like I say, I haven't watched an episode, so I didn't know that it wasn't straight-laced and very sort of hoorah militaristic. So it's interesting to hear you say that. But I do wonder, I mean, I don't know, it's so hard to judge, but I do wonder whether the fact that he's MacGyver was or wasn't a liability. I mean, obviously, yes, it brings name recognition. Everybody's going like, oh, MacGyver's in a new sci-fi show. You know, even I knew about it. And like I say, I couldn't even watch the damn thing. But even I knew that he was in it and that this show existed. So it certainly had that. But I do wonder if it may even have turned some people off. You know, people who watched MacGyver and went, oh yeah, but that's, I'm not watching some sci-fi stuff. Especially off the back of, wasn't Farscape around the same time? And I mean, that was another show that I never watched, but I gather it was roundly maligned by many, many people.
We could do a whole episode about that too.
Need to find somebody to defend Farscape.
Well, I'll talk my wife into doing it, because it's one of her favorite shows and I like it a lot. That's actually a very good show too, but it has been lost. Well, I mean, you could make that same argument for Babylon 5, which was taken to be a cut rate version of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and is not at all.
I think Babylon 5 gets away with it a little because it sold itself so much on the idea that this was an auteur show.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that was entirely true, it was very much sold as, this is one man's vision.
Right.
Behold. And I think maybe it gets a pass because of that.
Yeah. And this, you know, Stargate, yes, it is MGM saying, we want to make a TV franchise. On the business level, this is a cynical cash grab. Let's make a cheap Canadian knockoff of that movie that grossed $100 million and see how much money we can make. And I think it's to the credit of the production team that they actually made a pretty good show. And although I am here trying to defend it, the fact is it did well enough to last 10 years on the air, which is crazy for anything that isn't Doctor Who, essentially. 214 episodes plus two DVD, direct-to-DVD continuation movies. So, you know, however many hours of programming that is, it's a lot. So it obviously did well, but I think it was never considered the show. And I think what's happened really is in the last few years, partially because of how it ended weekly, but mostly what we've talked about different visions of the future and different stylistic choices have made it seem like a representative, that maybe even the last representative of kind of old sci-fi,
right,
rather than letting it stand on its own. And so I feel like the rehabbing of Stargate needs to begin, because it was a lot of fun and much better than a lot of its contemporaries at the beginning. It was, I think it was the best sci-fi show going for 3 or 4 years.
In a world where, you know, frankly, some quite good shows struggle to even last one season these days. I mean, 10 seasons is pretty remarkable, it must be said. Did even The X-Files last that long? I can't remember.
I think X-Files lasted 9, but then again, it was on a broadcast network where the bar is actually much higher, but they had the same problems of cast not wanting to be on anymore. No, 10 seasons and two spinoff live-action TV series, Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe. So they definitely, you know, this was a franchise with legs. How much of that was the studio wanting to give it legs, and how much of it was just the fact that there was an audience for it?
Yeah, how much of that was Enterprise versus DS9?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, well, I would say it's actually interesting. The spinoff, Stargate Atlantis, I think was not a particularly successful series creatively. I think they kind of got away from what they were trying to do. It was okay, but it wasn't great. It lasted 5 seasons, though. And then actually their attempt to do something, their Enterprise was Stargate Universe, which lasted 2 seasons, and honestly was problematic, but I kind of find it admirable. It was trying very hard to be a very different kind of show, a much more Battlestar Galactica concept, take on the Stargate concept. And I think people didn't want their Battlestar Galactica mixed with their Stargate in the end. And I think that was a creative problem. But I always say this when I talk about like the most recent season of Doctor Who, which was kind of prickly and didn't really care whether you liked it or not. But I loved it, but I appreciate more than anything else the fact that it was different. And it was a let's do a show that's not like the show we made last year. Let's just completely change it up. And the Stargate Universe was a little bit like that, where I didn't love the show, but I really liked the fact that 10 years into this franchise, they said, we're going to do something totally different with it. And they did.
When you try that sort of thing, you do often find yourself stuck between two worlds, though.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. The existing fans are like, well, but this is different. I just want more of the same.
Exactly.
And potential new fans are like, well, that's Stargate. I'm not touching that. So,
exactly.
You know, you're betwixt and between.
Well, I think that was the argument. I mean, we talked about trying to put Battlestar Galactica in Stargate. I think that was the argument with Caprica. From Battlestar Galactica it wasn't Battlestar Galactica. They literally couldn't do Battlestar Galactica because that was the end of the world. And so they do a prequel and they make it more like a soap about artificial intelligence and things like that, which is actually quite interesting, but it's not Battlestar Galactica. And any benefit you get is lost. And then you also have this barrier where other people are like, I haven't seen Battlestar Galactica, so I can't watch it. And then you're left with nobody watching it.
Yeah, that's a very common problem. I've come across that myself to doing transmedia work and the like. And yeah,
right.
it's a really tough barrier to overcome. Yeah, this isn't like the thing that it's called.
Yeah, I find this in the tech publishing industry. I was talking to somebody the other day who's got a website that is very successful with this one particular market. And that market, those people who read their website also are increasingly interested in this other thing that is not under the purview of that particular brand name. You know, so you've got Windows IT professionals and now they're interested in cloud computing or something like that. And the natural response is to say, well, we need to put some cloud computing in the Windows IT professional site. And what you'll find is that even though the people who read that site want to know about those things, they don't want it from this label.
They don't want it there.
Don't mess this up. This is where I come for X. I don't want Y here. And from the publisher's perspective, you're like, but, you know, X is fading away and Y is getting big and we need to do Y. But the audience sort of isn't interested. Even if they're interested in that other thing, they want it to be the other thing. So if you're the producers of Battlestar Galactica, do you say we're doing a prequel to Battlestar Galactica? Or do you say, hey, you liked that last show we did. We're doing a totally different show now. And that is fraught with much more danger that nobody's going to watch it. But at the same time, the comforting embrace of the existing brand that you've got may actually be a straitjacket because nobody may want to follow you where you need to go.
Well, and I was going to say that's another, you know, slightly ironic thing, and this is the same in publishing, because again, I've seen this myself. I used to work in magazines as well, and when you try to convince, when you don't extend the brand but you come up with something new that serves what your audience are asking for but it's completely separate, and then you say to them, okay, go over there, most of them don't, because it's new, it's different,
right.
It's something else, it's not their thing. So you're like, well, hang on, you don't want it in here, but you don't want to go to this new thing either. And
right.
It sounds like that was much the same with these Stargate spinoffs then.
Yeah, I think that was the case where Stargate Atlantis was more of the same and it lasted 5 years. Stargate Universe, creatively, a much bigger risk, I think much more interesting show, and lasted 2 seasons. And I'm surprised it lasted more than the one. And, you know, it's not their fault, because I actually think it was creatively a much more interesting decision than the Atlantis, which was really just like replicating Stargate, saying, what if we found another galaxy full of Stargates? Okay.
Yeah. All
right. It was like the Star Trek Voyager of Stargate.
Ooh. Yeah. That's not necessarily a recommendation, is it?
Yeah. I know people who like Voyager, but certainly in its premise, it was literally, we're far away from Earth. It's the old format, but we're cut off from home. That was the premise of Stargate Atlantis. It wasn't. Yeah. Anyway, so it's not cool, but I still love it. And this actually has made me want to go back and rewatch it from the beginning, because, it's fun. And, you know, fun is also, again, Battlestar Galactica, great show. Wouldn't necessarily call it fun. I think maybe there's things that are just fun don't always get the credit, because they're just, oh, that's just a fun show that I like to watch. And people don't like, oh, you've got to see it. It's just more like, no, it's fun.
Yeah, well, it's like Castle.
Right.
People, that's a good example. People who know me look askance when I tell them that I watch and enjoy Castle. And they're like, really? But it's fun. It's stupid and the plots don't make sense. And it's the most unrealistic show on television. But, you know, it's more unrealistic than most sci-fi shows. But it's fun. It makes me laugh, you know.
Fun is, I said this on an episode of The Incomparable the other week, which is, fun is underrated. I think we were talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. But it's that, you know, fun is underrated. People like to talk about serious things, and this was very serious and complicated and interesting, and this was great art. And I don't get me wrong, evaluating art and appreciating things that are very difficult and challenging, totally worth it. But at the same time, you cannot underrate the fact that sometimes you want to watch something or read something and say, that was so much fun. I had a great time experiencing that. And, you know, we should stop and appreciate that stuff too.
Yeah. It wasn't necessarily deep, but I enjoyed it.
Exactly.
There you go. There's a good summation for you.
I think so.
All right. So, Jason, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, if you liked all this nonsense about science fiction and things like that, you should go to theincomparable.com, which is the home of my podcast, The Incomparable, and a bunch of spinoffs about other things, Dungeons and Dragons and Star Trek and other TV shows and things like that. And if you want to know about computery things and Apple and other related technology stuff, you can go to my website, sixcolors.com.
And on Twitter, I believe you're Jay Snell. Is that right?
I am. I'm really on Twitter all the time. So if you want to peer into my brain, go to Jay Snell on Twitter.
Two L's.
Two L's. Good. Very good. Well done.
And there's the theme music. You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, Episode 1, with Anthony Johnston and Jason Snell. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
One of these days you're going to see an episode of Stargate and say, oh my God, it's so terrible. What was he talking about?
What has he got me into? Oh no. I must admit, I think I mentioned this to you in email. I'd never watched Babylon 5, and then listening to your Incomparable discussion about it made me think, you know, maybe I should. Because again, it was one where friends I had watched it, and I saw bits and pieces here and there. I know Bruce Boxleitner was in it, and that's pretty much it.
Right.
And then it had dodgy CGI graphics that were quite advanced for the time, but not anymore.
It was, I think, the first show to do all CGI. And by the time they went off the air, Star Trek had switched to CGI. It actually was right at that point. But now you look back on it, and they shot that on film in 16:9. And I keep thinking, one of these days they're going to go back. And what they need to do is they just need to recreate all the effects, because it was too early.
Right. And then the effects are awful. A big Blu-ray set or something. Exactly. In 16:9. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It does kind of seem like that's a bit of an obvious thing to do. I wonder if there's a reason why they haven't.
It costs, but there are rumors that they're going to do it. It costs, but they did it with Star Trek. They just did it with the X-Files.
Yep. Oh, those remastered Star Treks are gorgeous, aren't they?
Aren't they?
Yeah, they're showing them on CBS Drama, or you know, one of the kind of perpetual rerun channels that we get over here on our digital networks. And yeah, the absolutely, you know, watching them in on an HD TV is just amazing. You like, I mean, obviously they look dated, but in terms of the sort of filmic quality, they look as if they could have been made yesterday. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit like, when they went from black and white to color, there are syndication, like Gilligan's Island was a show I watched as a child because it was on TV and I had nothing better to do apparently. And the first season of Gilligan's Island was in black and white. And so I've never seen those episodes because they weren't put in the package, the syndication package, because they figured nobody wants to watch a black and white TV show.
Ah.
And I believe they colorized them in the 90s. I looked this up and they are now they've been colorized. Well, it's Gilligan's Island. I'm not too worried about the artistic intent of the director, but that it's a little like that in the sense that, standard definition shows aren't going to be sellable very soon if that isn't already the case. And so anybody who's got a show that was shot on film, if those studios ever want to make any money from that product ever again, they're going to have to remaster it in HD like they did with Star Trek.
Going to have to invest a little,
They will have to spend a little bit of money, but then they get something that they can sell for another 20 years,
It's something loved like Star Trek or The X-Files.
Right, if nobody cares, then although, you know, it is expensive to do. I've even heard that even though they've just done all of Star Trek The Next Generation and it looks beautiful, there's still an open question about whether they will go ahead and do Deep Space Nine. Because they're not sure whether the money will be worth it. I think that's stupid because even if the Blu-ray sales aren't worth it, it's not just the Blu-ray sales. It's then you get it on Netflix and Amazon and, you know, and in syndication. And it's just, that's what you sell. And it keeps, you know, it keeps making you money that you won't make if you don't do it. But
money from cult hits, especially, isn't it? Because DS9, as I'm given to understand, was, you know, sort of, was like you were saying about something like BSG, critically acclaimed, but not... Yes. Not widely viewed,
right? You know. Exactly. In fact, I think it's benefited from being out of the shadow of Next Generation. That now people I talk to about Star Trek, and when I listen to Scott McNulty's podcast about it, Deep Space Nine has come to be like the consensus best Star Trek show, which is surprising.
I wonder if that's. If that relates to what we were saying about sort of the generational shift of TV, because DS9 just does feel more like a sort of modern show.
Well, they have actual story arcs and things that Next Generation never did. You can actually divide the line right there that those shows were on even for a couple years simultaneously, and yet one of them was never anything but standalone episodes, and the other one ended its run with story arcs, season-wide story arcs. So that's when it all changed.
Also, no fun.